Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
When Satchel got to the ballpark, it was like the sun just came out. Thus spoke Jimmy Crutchfield, who teamed up with Satchel Paige on the Birmingham Black Barons and the Pittsburgh Crawfords, two of the Negro League clubs for which Paige starred during the 20s and the 30s. According to Larry Tye, the author of a new biography titled Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, Jimmy Crutchfield's claim is by no means the most extravagant one made about Satchel Paige, who may have won more games than any other man who ever climbed a pitcher's mound. When I had the opportunity to speak with Larry Tye this week, I began by suggesting that to some extent, Paige's boyhood resembled the early days of another baseball giant, Babe Ruth, since both of them spent time in institutions that were half correctional facility, half orphanage. I asked Larry to discuss what had brought the 12-year-old Satchel Paige to what was then called the Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers.
What brought him there was an irresistible urge to put in his pocket some of the trinkets that he saw in a five-and-dime store when he was walking by one day. And if this had been the only infraction that he'd been caught for, he would never have ended up there. But part of the myth about how Satchel got his name includes my favorite story of the several alternatives out there, that instead of it being that he was carrying all these bags with a rope and pulley system and that his friends dubbed him a walking satchel tree, the better story is that he actually nabbed bags rather than just carried them. And one day, a guy caught him and gave him a whack, and his friend saw it and dubbed him forever Satchel.
So he was perhaps less a walking satchel tree than a running satchel thief.
Absolutely. That's at least what one friend, Wilbur Hines, tells as a story.
Once Satchel Paige began pitching professionally at the age of 18, more or less, nobody's still entirely sure, I guess, he started establishing the pattern that qualified him as the champion contract jumper of all time or as pro baseball's first free agent. Do you regard him as one or the other or as both?
I think he was definitely both. He never saw a contract that he wasn't willing to break, and he was so incredibly talented on the baseball field that he never broke a contract with an owner that the owner wasn't willing to re-up as soon as Satchel would come back. Everybody knew Satchel would draw the crowds, they'd fill the pockets of the owners, and so they were willing to give him another shot. And that's what made him be such an extraordinary free agent, was it wasn't just that he jumped contracts, but he ended up being able to raise the bar on salaries for Negro leaguers. Owners were willing to pay and do business with him, and that ended up raising everybody's price that they could demand, all of his teammates, be it Josh Gibson or more anonymous players. And Satchel was, 50 years before Major League Baseball ended up incorporating this new system of free agency, Satchel was, in fact, a free agent.
Beginning in 1927, Paige pitched for the Birmingham Black Barons, although not exclusively. He pitched in Cuba during the winter and in Baltimore on the occasions when the Baltimore Black Sox outbid the Black Barons for his services. At what point did fans begin to recognize Satchel Paige as something special?
I think the journalists recognized it very early on, and while they couldn't decide on just how to spell his first name or whether to use his first or last name, they recognized early on that this was a guy who had extraordinary skills. Fans picked it up about the same time. They were watching this guy go out there, and while he was wild and while he might hit more batters, it said at one game that he hit just about every batter that he faced. The fact was, he could still burn it in at speeds that people were estimating were somewhere over 100 miles an hour. He ended up learning accuracy, and there was a sense that he was a showman and that he could boast and that he could back up every boast that he made.
Although Satchel Paige is known for his extraordinary durability, he did experience an injury that he thought might be a career ender in 1938, and the injury led to his association with J.L. Wilkinson, who owned the Kansas City Monarchs, as well as a sort of farm club that he maintained for the Monarchs. How crucial was the connection between those two?
It was crucial in a number of ways. Wilkinson rescued Satchel. The farm club that you were talking about, they dubbed the Baby Monarchs. And Wilkinson rescued Satchel at a time when it looked like his arm was dead and that he'd never come back and be anything again. And Wilkinson had him pitch. He had him play the infield and the outfield. He basically brought him back. He was the only white owner in the Negro Leagues. He appreciated what players had done for him in accepting him, and Wilkinson wanted to give it back. But he also had this hope that Satchel could come back, could make it to the actual Monarchs, and could be a star again. And we now know, while then nobody could diagnose just what he had, and Satchel gave lots of colorful stories, we now think that it was a torn rotator cuff, and he did what anybody does these days for that kind of injury. He rested it. He pitched very little. He was playing the field. He wasn't playing for part of the time. And he came back, as we now know, even more phenomenal than he had been when he was injured.
And then on one mysterious day, suddenly his arm was whole, his fastball was there, and though everybody kept saying, hey, take it easy, that was not what he wanted to do.
Yeah, Satchel tells five wonderful stories about that. One of them was...
Only five.
And my favorite of those five is that he was playing around on a rainy day with a teammate who punched him as hard as he could in the back. And Satchel said, something is different about me. Nobody was sure whether he was even going to stand up. But he said, something has happened. And he said, let's go outside and I want to throw a baseball. And of course, he went outside, burned the baseball in, and that was the end of the injury. The fact was he had been resting, and his comeback, while he dramatized it, was a classic case of a player doing the right thing. Satchel understood his body probably better than any ball player ever has, which is how he could get away with pitching just about every day, three or four innings, just about every day of the year, and do it for 40 years. He had durability. He understood how to take care of himself. And even when he had a bad injury, he understood how to come back from it.
Now, am I to assume from this that you do not subscribe to the mysterious medicinal properties of the yellow juice?
I subscribe to the yellow juice in a wonderful way, because how could you not subscribe to a story that started with a guy named Jew Baby Floyd?
He was the trainer.
He was the trainer for the Kansas City Monarchs, and he was essentially Satchel's personal trainer. He gave him massages every day. He gave him exactly the right kind of prescriptions for ice and then heat, and he also gave him this wonderful stuff called yellow juice, which was so pungent that even the mosquitoes were scared away by it.
At one point, you write of Satchel Paige, and I'm quoting now, nothing happened to Satchel that was not worthy of a story. It's an intriguing thought. What are some of the most exceptional things that happened to Satchel Paige?
Well, there are a couple stories I'd love to share with you. One is that when he finally made it to the major leagues, Wilkinson, J.L. Wilkinson, who we were talking about before, was his patron saint in the Negro Leagues. In the major leagues, it was Bill Veeck, probably the most colorful of all the managers. And it was Veeck who brought him to the Cleveland Indians, who later brought him to the Miami Marlins and to the St. Louis Browns. And Veeck was intrigued by Satchel's ability to never recognize a face. He, one day, Groucho Marx came in and was talking to him and got an autograph from him when Satchel was in the whirlpool. And Satchel asked everybody, when Groucho finally left, who the heck was that guy? And he had no clue who most people were from the waist up. But Veeck performed a little experiment, which was he took pictures of about 25 ball players from the waist down with no identifying marks in terms of uniforms or anything else, and he showed it to his entire pitching staff. The best that anybody did other than Satchel was guessing who six of the players were. Mm-hmm. Satchel guessed 18. And Satchel had this extraordinary ability to know what was important. He might seem like a space cadet. He might seem like he was never paying attention. But to the important things, like how to get a batter out, he was an extraordinary artist.
You discovered that in 1936, the New York Yankees sent for Satchel Paige because they wanted him to pitch to a young fellow named Joe DiMaggio just so they could see how good Joe DiMaggio really was. This, of course, is 11 years before Jackie Robinson broke into the major league. Satchel couldn't pitch for the Yankees officially, obviously. How did that encounter go?
Joe was at the time 21 years old, and the Yankees weren't sure whether this guy was for real. So the way to test it out was to bring in the best pitcher they could find, Satchel Paige. And the first three times that Joe was up at bat that day against Satchel, he couldn't get a hit. The fourth time up at bat was in the 10th inning, a man on third, two outs, and the score tied at one. This extraordinary face-off, Satchel on the mound and DiMaggio up at bat. DiMaggio hits a hard one off of Satchel's glove. Satchel deflects it to the second baseman, who tosses it to the first baseman about 1 second too late. What that meant was the runner from third scored, and the Yankee scout, who was so delighted, telegraphed his bosses in the Bronx, and the telegraph read simply, "DiMaggio, all we hope to be, hit Satchel 1-for-4. Can I actually tell you, I love that story partly because of the credibility that Satchel's pitching had, but I also love it because Satchel said after the fact that this was, in a way, one of the sad things that had happened to him throughout his career. Mm. That teams like the Yankees would bring him in to test out their young pitchers, but when DiMaggio would head off afterwards to Broadway, Satchel would head back to Outer Mongolia and barnstorming in the Negro Leagues. DiMaggio said in later years that Satchel was the best pitcher he had ever faced, and he actually went on to say that Satchel gave him optical indigestion with his curveball, and as far as his fastball went, all the catcher saw was ashes. DiMaggio, Williams, all of these great ball players, all of these great batters were incredibly impressed with Satchel, and yet nothing they could do could bring him to the major leagues.
See, you tell that story, and I have a picture in my head of Satchel Paige saying behind his hand to Joe DiMaggio, "Hey, tell him I give you optical indigestion."
Exactly. He was so wonderful at composing quotes, and DiMaggio was so grateful for that hit that I wouldn't doubt that that had happened.
No other player in the Negro Leagues made nearly as much money as Satchel Paige did. In fact, he maintained several times that he would have had to take a pay cut to join a major league team if he had been invited to do so. Was it true?
It was not only true, he proved it right when he did finally get signed and he did take a pay cut. In the 1930s, Satchel was earning $40,000 a year. Now, you want to compare that is what DiMaggio was earning, but it was twice what Ted Williams was earning with the Boston Red Sox, and it was four times what the average Yankee was making. And yet, like everything with Satchel, it comes with an asterisk. And the asterisk is that while Satchel made his money by pitching every day, all year round, most of these major leaguers got the winter off and pitched every fourth or fifth night.
Beyond what he achieved on the ball field, and of course that achievement was enormous, you give Satchel Paige a lot of credit for advancing the cause of minorities wherever he went. How did he do that?
He did it in two different ways. Some of it was very overt, and Satchel said anytime he accepted a gig to go and do a barnstorming game in a town, he said, "I will only come if my fellow black ball players and I are given a place to eat and a place to sleep." And he was setting this condition at a time in the 1920s and 30s when that was just unheard of, particularly in southern towns that he was going to that were still firmly entrenched in racial segregation. So it was partly that overt approach, and it was partly by going out and doing these extraordinary things to disarm and then dazzle fans across America. And he brought the attention of the white press, and he brought the attention of white fans to Negro League baseball in a way that set the table for Jackie Robinson. There was one wonderful old leaguer who said, "Jackie opened the door to integration, but Satchel inserted the key."
Satchel Paige and Jackie Robinson were not exactly fans of each other, though. Why was that?
Bill, you're a diplomat. Jackie, in fact, couldn't stand Satchel, and the feelings were mutual. Satchel resented Jackie for a number of reasons. One, he never thought that he was as great a ball player in the Kansas City Monarchs as deserved to get Branch Rickey's attention and get signed by the Brooklyn Dodgers. He also resented the fact that Jackie never seemed to have much good to say about the Negro Leagues. He only played for the Negro Leagues for 1 year, and he had disdain for all these great old veterans, and Satchel couldn't abide by that. But most of all, Satchel couldn't abide by the fact that he had disdain for him. Jackie thought that Satchel was a showman. He thought that he was a bit of a disgrace in terms of not being this proud image of a very serious ball player. And he thought that he was just an old man who had seen his better days. And their attitudes to one another were sort of sad because they started out as teammates who got along. But once Jackie was signed, it brought up resentments in Satchel.
Satchel Paige was well past his prime when he finally did get a chance to pitch in the major leagues in 1948, but he had some impressive stretches with the Cleveland Indians and then with the St. Louis Browns, although he didn't much relish the discipline associated with those teams and their managers. How many games do you suppose he would have won if there had been no color line?
Well, he says that he won 2,000 games as it was.
2000.
And I initially thought, that's great. Just totally off the wall. And I went back and looked at the guy who had pitched and won the most games in the major leagues, and Satchel was claiming to have pitched in twice as many games as Jesse Orosco, 2,500 games. He said he won 2,000 of those. And so I went back and started looking at the numbers. And when you look at the fact that Satchel pitched three or four innings just about every night, and when you look at the fact that he pitched all year long, and when you look at the fact that he pitched for more than 40 years, I concluded at the end that he was underestimating how many games he had pitched at and probably how many he won.
Fairly late in his life, Satchel Paige said, "Most people think old Satch is either dead or rich." He died at home in Kansas City in 1982, and I gather that at that time, despite all the money that he had made and the much greater amounts that he had generated for other people, he wasn't rich.
He wasn't rich in part because he had kids late in life, and he had seven kids that he had to support long after he had filled his closet with suits, after he had four closets to hold those suits and one just for his shoes. He indulged himself over the years extraordinarily. So when he died, it was partly sad that he died without a whole lot of money. It was also sad that a guy, as you and your listeners know, who for all of his famous quotes was most famous for the quote, "Don't look back, somebody might be gaining on you." For the first time in his life, in his later years, he looked back. He was a bit overwhelmed by all the injustices done to him. He was upset that too few people remembered him. And he died far too bitter for a guy who spent most of his life incredibly upbeat.
Larry Tye is the author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, published by Random House. Larry, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with me.
Thanks for having me in.
My conversation with Larry Tye, the author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be talking with Her High Eminence of the Hip Check, Helene Elliott, about the result of Game 7 in the Stanley Cup Finals. We'll have a story about star Kansas City Royals pitcher Zach Greinke, whose social anxiety disorder nearly prevented him from continuing his promising baseball career. And as the WNBA teams play their way into the summer, I'll speak with Sports Illustrated's Kelly Anderson about the second comeback of Shamiqua Holdsclaw, which is underway in Atlanta. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.